From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are hearing from more lawmakers who want Attorney General Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from overseeing investigations by the FBI and the Justice Department into ties Donald Trump's campaign or associates may have had to Russia during the election. News broke last night that Sessions spoke with the Russian ambassador twice last year, but in his confirmation hearings to become Attorney General in January, he did not disclose those conversations. Senator Al Franken asked Sessions what he would do if there is any evidence that anyone affiliated with the Trump campaign communicated with the Russian government in the course of the campaign. Here's Sessions' response.
I have been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I didn't have communications with the Russians, and I'm unable to comment on it.
Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. And Ron, first, just go through the chain of events. What do we know about what Sessions did?
The key moment was the moment in January you just mentioned. It was January 10th. Al Franken asked about contacts between the campaign and the Russians, and he did not say, "Did you have any contacts?" It was not a question directed at the activities of Senator Sessions, but Senator Sessions volunteered that, number one, he didn't know about any such activity, and number two, he had been something of a surrogate for the campaign, and he had had no contact with the Russians. So if you go back 1 year, March 3rd, 2016, that's when Donald Trump made Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, the chairman of his Committee for National Security Affairs. Then in July, he met with the Russian ambassador, who's widely regarded in Washington, D.C. as an intelligence asset, let's put it that way, for Vladimir Putin. He met with him in July. He met with him again in September in his office. And then when he was asked about it during his confirmation hearings, he was not forthcoming about having had those meetings.
And he was under oath there. Are there legal questions about that, that he told the Senate Judiciary Committee that he didn't have communications with the Russians?
A number of people have been asked that question today, and generally their response is, talk to someone who does perjury law for a living. It is a complicated legal area whether the lack of full disclosure constitutes perjury, even under oath.
Well, let's listen to how some lawmakers are reacting. Republican Senator Marco Rubio is on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is investigating Russian interference in the presidential election. Here he is today on Morning Edition.
There's one thing to say the ambassadors in America trying to get close to people that could be influential in the new administration. I think every ambassador is trying to do that. The problem is that this is regards Russia, and it regards their potential interference, or what I believe is their actual interference in our election process. So it is concerning.
Now, Democrats have had a stronger reaction than Republicans. Here's Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer at a press conference this morning.
Look, the attorney general is the chief law enforcement officer of the land, and already his integrity and independence has been questioned. It would be better for the country if he'd resign.
But is there something wrong?
The main point I am making here is we need an investigation to get to the bottom of this. Better for the country if he resigns, but let's get a real investigation going.
And House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi also called for Sessions' resignation. She was asked why many Republicans have called on Sessions to recuse himself, but have stopped short of calling for a special prosecutor in these investigations. Here's what she said.
What does it say about them that their chief law enforcement officer, the top cop in the country, lied to his colleagues in the Senate and to the American people, a person who himself knows about prosecution and knows about the law and knows about perjury and its penalties?
So, Ron, where does all this go from here?
When you look at the short but growing list of Republicans who are calling for recusal, not resignation, of course, but recusal for Jeff Sessions to get out of the way of wherever this investigation may go, that would appear to be the middle ground at this juncture. Now, the White House has said it didn't know about the contacts that Jeff Sessions had. They are certainly not criticizing him, at least not yet. But there does not seem to be any safe place for Jeff Sessions to stand with respect to conducting, or as the Attorney General general overseeing the conducting of the investigation into Russian interference in our election. Now, if he chooses to recuse himself, who then takes over? Is it his deputy, whoever that is at that point, because we have an acting deputy now, we're going to have a permanent deputy later, or is it going to be a special prosecutor in the old Watergate sort of style? That would take some doing. It would take some involvement by Congress, but that's what the Democrats are really calling for. They want it to be independent.
And just briefly, how big of a problem is this for the White House after that speech that the president got some good reviews on the other day?
Yes, they did, and they got a nice bounce in the stock market, 300 points on the Dow the next day, and a lot of nice things that had been said about the president that hadn't been said by those people before, and they would love to be dwelling on that for the rest of the week. But instead, we now know about Jeff Sessions and his contacts with the Russians.
Everything changes so quickly in Washington. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And today marks 100 years since President Woodrow Wilson signed a law granting U.S. citizenship to Puerto Ricans. But the island is not a state. Puerto Ricans don't have representation in Congress, nor can they vote in presidential elections. And the anniversary comes at a time when people there are once again asking if its relationship with the U.S. needs to change. NPR's Greg Allen joins us from Miami. And Greg, what's been the reaction to this anniversary in Puerto Rico?
Well, in Puerto Rico, it's an issue that I think people are aware of, but it's not a day that people are really, you know, observing your typical person. The governor signed a proclamation there to observe it, and there was a ceremony held today. But there has been, you know, pushback on that as well. There's an independence party in Puerto Rico, and a legislature there yesterday had an impassioned discussion about why they shouldn't observe this anniversary. And I've been told that there's some protesters out today, independence activists who are holding banners that say 100 years is enough. So it's definitely a mixed story there.
Well, remind us what rights Puerto Ricans have. I mean, do they collect U.S. Social Security? What taxes do they pay? That kind of thing.
Right. Well, it's a territory, and that's always been somewhat of a loaded term used in Puerto Rico because they don't really – they've always called themselves a commonwealth, and there's always been a sense that they have a certain amount of sovereignty. Mm-hmm. They can't – as we said at the top, they can't vote for president. They don't have elected officials in Congress, which is key in terms of determining how they're affected by laws. They do pay Social Security and Medicare taxes. They don't pay a federal income tax, but they pay plenty of taxes to the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico because that's where many of their services come from. Mm-hmm. But they're treated differently by federal laws in many ways, including the U.S. bankruptcy code, which became an issue last year when they ran into this huge problem with their $70 billion debt and they couldn't put some of their institutions through bankruptcy, which has happened in places like Detroit and elsewhere. So in many ways, they felt like they have a second-class citizenship.
As you mentioned, there are some pro-independence protesters out today, and some politicians there are pushing for statehood. Others are pushing for independence. Can you tell us more about the likelihood of either of those outcomes?
Well, this issue of status, you know, what's your political status? What's the relationship of Puerto Rico to the U.S.? That has been, for 100 years, been the main story there, the main issue. The three political parties there all have a different position here. One party is the statehood party. One party is the Commonwealth or the status quo party, and one party, much smaller, is the Independence Party. Independence used to be a very strong movement in Puerto Rico for the first part of the last century. You know, it led to attacks on Congress. Independence activists tried to assassinate Harry Truman in 1950, and then there was an armed attack on Congress where five members of Congress were shot and wounded in 1954, I believe that was. Since then, independence has kind of lost steam in Puerto Rico. Certainly the militant part is gone. Mm. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that many more Puerto Ricans live in America now, live in the U.S., the mainland. Mm-hmm. And that constant movement back and forth has done a lot to kind of bring the island much closer to the mainland. In terms of the likelihood of statehood, I think it's growing on the island. Support is growing somewhat on the island, but we had a referendum in 2012, and although it won, it did not really win conclusively the way it was worded. It was not convincing to a lot of people that there's a real strong consensus for statehood. So The other option besides statehood would be an independence is status quo. That's been undercut somewhat in the last few years by decisions that have come out of Washington. The Supreme Court had decisions which say that Puerto Rico doesn't have the sovereignty that many people on the island long believed they did. Mm. And then also, as we mentioned, we have the debt issue, and Congress has imposed a federal oversight board on Puerto Rico and its finances. And that took a lot of authority away from the island and led a lot of people there to start to talk about colonial rule from Washington.
That's right. Puerto Rico has been dealing with this devastating debt crisis, an estimated $7 billion
deficit. That has affected the debate a lot.
Exactly. And right now we're in the middle of it there because the government, the new governor there, had to come up with his own proposed budget, which he submits to the oversight board. His budget makes cuts, but they do so without actually laying off a lot of state workers there. Still, his cuts would be very painful, but they fall short, many people believe, of what the oversight board wants and what they've asked for. So now we're waiting to see what the oversight board's going to say. They're going to come back with probably more cuts, more austerity, which will be very tough for people to accept in Puerto Rico. So we could likely see demonstrations and a big pushback there. All that kind of is likely to kind of add to the atmosphere as we head toward the June 11th referendum on status. It'll be interesting to see what the vote is, but then ultimately it's up to Congress. And Puerto Rico's voted four times before on status, and Congress has never acted after any one of those. Given the atmosphere, what's going on in Washington, it's kind of doubtful that they're going to say, now's the time for us to make Puerto Rico a state.
NPR's Greg Allen, marking 100 years of a law granting U.S. citizenship to Puerto Ricans. Greg, thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump told Congress on Wednesday that his administration has created a deregulation task force inside every government agency. And last week, his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, raised eyebrows when he said this at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
If you look at these cabinet appointees, they were selected for a reason, and that is the deconstruction. The way the progressive left runs is if they can't get it passed, they're just going to put it in some sort of regulation in an agency. That's all going to be deconstructed.
The idea of deconstructing the so-called administrative state was a hallmark of President Trump's campaign, but there's also precedent for this. Historians Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers are co-hosts of the podcast Backstory, which brings historical perspective to events that are happening today. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
It's great to be here.
And let's start with looking at what Steve Bannon is saying there. Ed, how do you interpret this idea of deconstructing the administrative state?
So deconstructing, obviously, not just dismantling, but some ways destroying.
Driving a stake through the heart.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the administrative state, you'd be surprised to know that Brian Ballow is actually the leading historian of this subject, and I'm not kidding. And so as much as it pains me to give up a nanosecond of airtime, I'm actually going to ask Brian to explain what the heck is the administrative state and why would we want to deconstruct?
Oh, hold on, Ed. Let me just replace my pocket protector first. I just have to say that many presidents, and they're not all Republicans, they're just determined to take apart this behemoth, the administrative state. And probably the most famous one is Ronald Reagan. Reagan said that government is not the solution to our problems. Government is the problem, and he was going to dismantle that government. Well, long story short, he failed to do that. He built up the military to a much greater status, more people in it, and actually more employees after the end of the Reagan administration. And to achieve his objectives, he did some of the very same things that Trump is doing to achieve his. What Ronald Reagan really wanted to dismantle was the welfare state, and he had limited success in doing that. So there's a long history of presidents coming in saying they're going to take on the bureaucracy. What they really mean is they're going to try to shift the emphasis of where those bureaucrats are going to work and how they're going to spend their time towards achieving objectives that presidents want to achieve.
Well, and what about presidents on their way out? We know the famous speech that Dwight Eisenhower gave in 1961, his farewell address to America. Let's listen to a little bit.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Now, you say he said that, but in fact, he didn't really do that.
Well, in fairness to President Eisenhower, he did try hard. He was what we would call a deficit hawk today. He tried so hard to balance the budget. And until 1957, Eisenhower did a very good job of keeping down military spending. He ended the Korean War, and he was able to keep a lid on military spending. And then, Ed, what happened in 1957?
I believe there were rockets launched by other people.
That's exactly right. The Soviet Union launched Sputnik, and Americans just freaked out, and especially Democrats. They said, you know, we're not spending enough. The Russians are getting ahead of us.
There's a missile gap.
There is a missile gap, and actually that's one of the reasons that John F. Kennedy beat Richard Nixon in the 1960 election. But poor Eisenhower continued to argue for balanced budgets, but basically a Democratic Congress steamrolled him, and military spending went way up. And regardless of spending amounts, Eisenhower presided over the construction of the military-industrial complex.
This is also the second time this week that we have played that exact clip from Dwight D. Eisenhower on Here and Now, because just the other day, the Trump White House said that they wanted to increase the military budget by $54 billion, or about 10%. Doesn't sound like his warning has been heeded at all.
Let's play it again, Jeremy.
Well, here's the thing that I think we might want to think about is that Steve Bannon, the chief strategist for President Trump, argues that these analogies with the past are irrelevant, Brian, because we are living in a time of redefinition of American history. And these other precedences or lack of precedent is not really—
Hold on. How are we redefining things?
Well, because we're coming up on the fourth turning of American history.
Oh, is that the warning I have on my calendar?
So, Jeremy, I don't know if you've heard about this.
Well, but yes, he thinks there's going to be another war.
Well, he is very much influenced by this book called The Fourth Turning, written by the guys who invented the concept of millennials. And his idea is, the idea of this book, is that American history is determined by the succession of generations, and that American history can be broken up into 80-year periods, and they point out, isn't it spooky that there's exactly the same amount of time between the Declaration of Independence and the Civil War, and the Civil War and
Ooh.
World War II? You telling me that's an accident? I think not. It's the way that generations succeed themselves and shape those who follow. And at the end of each of these 80-year periods, what do we have? At the end of the first 80 years, the Civil War. At the end of the next 80 years, World War II. How long has it been since World War II? We're coming up on the time for another war.
I'm doing the math. That's scary.
Let me just bring us back around to the original point, which was deconstructing the administrative state.
Right.
Because I know that you wanted to talk about something that happened a long time ago, back in the 1870s, the dismantling of Reconstruction.
Yeah, if you think about the one time that the federal state suddenly surged into activity, doing the biggest thing the American state has ever done, which is end the largest and most powerful system of slavery in the modern world through a massive war, and then create a completely unprecedented national bureaucracy and enforce it with troops on American soil, there's nothing like Reconstruction, which just happens to rhyme with deconstruction, you'll notice.
Right.
And so if you think of this cyclical model that Bannon has, that should have been a cleansing time, that the wars come along and destroy what is bad. Well, slavery is obviously bad, but for generations, Reconstruction was understood as a great travesty. And I actually find it hard to believe that the same people who talk about deconstructing the administrative state today would think it was a great idea to have this federal power then. So my point is that the cyclical model just doesn't hold up. So does this make sense to you, Jeremy?
Yes, but I have to bring us to the most important topic of the day, which is Judge Wapner.
Oh, yeah, that's heavy.
Judge, the People's Court.
Judge Joseph Wapner died a few days ago, and of course people remember from TV in the 80s and 90s, the trail he blazed.
Both parties in the suit have agreed to dismiss their court cases and have their dispute settled here in our forum, the People's Court.
Now, Brian, you say Judge Wapner's courtroom TV show harkened back to the days of the 19th century.
That's right. Back in the 19th century, if you had a legal dispute, You went to the local judge. You went to a justice of the peace. You might go to a magistrate in a city like Chicago. And the judge would often decide whether, you know, you had voted the right way in the last election in Chicago, what he thought about your cousin. It was a very common sense. There wasn't a lot of legal mumbo jumbo.
Or law.
But it was very direct. And I think that, you know, by the 1980s, we'd become such a litigious society and so specialized in judicial concepts. And also, Jeremy, that judiciary, that third branch of government, it is so removed from the lives of most Americans.
They dress in robes.
We don't really see. So Judge Wapner, the People's Court, you know, he gave millions and millions of people. Do you know that at the peak of his popularity, something like 60% of Americans knew who Judge Wapner was, but only, I don't know, 9% of Americans knew who the Chief Justice was. It was Rehnquist, by the way.
And Judge Judy, by the way, is still, I think, the most highly paid person on television today.
Yeah, she beat Judge Wapner soundly. They were on the TV at the same time, and she came up. So what did she have that he didn't?
Well,
Jeremy stole my line. I mean, she really had very cutting, biting kind of sense
still
of
has.
Humor. Still has. That's right. That's what I – Judge Wapner actually had a kind of decorum to him.
Historians Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow, they are the co-hosts of the podcast Backstory, which brings historical perspective to events that are happening today, including television shows like The People's Court. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, Jeremy. A lot of fun.
We'll be offering the verdict in just a moment. It's Here and Now.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Those two accountants from PricewaterhouseCoopers who were involved in the Best Picture mishap at the Oscars will not be invited back. That's according to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Academy President Cheryl Boone Isaacs told the AP that the Academy's relationship with PwC is also under review. So what does this flub mean for PwC and the other accounting firms that take part in award shows? Nathan Bomey is a reporter for USA Today. He joins us now. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And PwC is an accounting firm based in London, one of the biggest in the world with about $36 billion in revenue last year. Does it matter what just happened at the Academy Awards for their bottom line?
Well, I don't think it necessarily matters for the bottom line from a profit perspective, but it matters with regard to their reputation, because the Big Four accounting firms bet their entire business on trust, because they do what is called a credence good, which means that their entire business is difficult for the average person, even the average executive, to value in the sense that after they conduct what their accounting or auditing work, we don't really know, the average person doesn't really know whether they did what they were promised to do. So you trust them. It's about their brand. And when their brand takes a hit like this, that's not a good thing.
And Ernst & Young, one of their competitors, audits the Emmys and Golden Globe Awards. Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu audits the Grammy Awards. Why do they do these things? Is this part of their kind of PR strategy to be involved in these award shows? Because it seems like it doesn't really have that much to do with what they do on a daily basis.
Right. I don't think they're making much money off of this, so I think the PR is a big part of it. In fact, you've seen PwC really ramp up its social media presence with regard to the Oscars in the last few years. And, of course, we now know that one of the partners involved in this mistake was on his phone, was on Twitter minutes before it happened. And so they understand that this burnishes the brand. The problem is that it just sets them up for the second there's a mistake, then it just casts a spotlight on all of those activities that have taken place online. Easy to see now.
And when you look at the overall business models of these accounting firms, you write that automation is a much bigger threat.
It is. It's funny. I did a big project in automation just a few weeks ago for USA Today and actually spoke to PwC at the time. And they said they believe 40% of their auditing and accounting process can be automated. And so they're actually moving quickly toward that. This is a business where automation will have a significant effect. You know, we think of automation as affecting only, you know, people who are doing low paid jobs. But the reality is it will actually sweep through many, quote unquote, white collar positions. Accounting is one of those. So I don't think that the Academy Awards process is going to be automated anytime soon, but you can certainly expect that accountants will have to adapt.
And do you expect that the Academy Awards will sever their relationship with PwC?
You know, I've had this conversation with several people, and I think it's going to be very difficult for the Academy to continue that relationship because of how public this mistake was. And so the fact that they're reviewing the relationship is not a surprise at all. Perhaps ultimately they can chalk this up to just, you know, a physical mistake, and so it doesn't necessarily speak to their overall process. But the real issue here is accounting firms' entire business is to make sure that companies and organizations have internal controls in place to keep mistakes from happening. And if you can't keep a mistake like this from happening, then it does cast some aspersions on the rest of your process. Again, I don't think people are really questioning PwC's general accounting, but this is just a public mistake that really causes people to think twice.
That's Nathan Bomey, a reporter with USA Today. Nathan, thanks.
All right. Hey, thanks so much.
The most moving moment of President Trump's address to a joint session of Congress Tuesday night was when he acknowledged Karen Owens. She's the widow of the decorated Navy SEAL commando killed in a U.S. ground raid on an al-Qaeda safe house in Yemen in late January. Chief Petty Officer William Owens, known as Ryan, was a member of the elite SEAL Team 6. He was 36 years old and a father of three.
Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation.
Karen Owens' tears inspired a rare bipartisan moment of lengthy applause. During the speech, President Trump called the raid highly successful and said it generated, quote, large amounts of vital intelligence. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman reports that vital is a bit of a stretch. Citing military sources, Bowman says the raid did yield information on al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's activities and methods, but there was nothing to act on right away, and it's far too soon to tell how important the cell phones and computers captured will prove in American counterterrorism. The Pentagon has ordered an investigation to determine whether innocent women and children were killed in the raid. A London-based human rights group reports that 10 children were killed. And Ryan's father, Bill, called it a stupid mission. He refused to meet President Trump at Dover Air Force Base when his son's remains returned home. Bill Owens told the Miami Herald he wants answers. There are lots of questions about the raid and hour-long firefight in remote central Yemen. What went wrong and why? Three other Navy SEALs were injured and a $75 million aircraft was lost. Don Mann is a retired Navy SEAL who served for 21 years. He's the author of several books, including Inside SEAL Team 6, My Life and Missions with America's Elite Warriors. He's with us from WLRN in Miami. Don Mann, welcome to Here and Now. And there are lots of questions about this raid, but let's start with the mission itself. What do you understand was the main goal?
The mission, as we know it, was to collect valuable intelligence that may be actionable or may not be actionable, but could help us in the long run tracking down further attacks, planning, and other training in terrorist activities.
So when looking at the word valuable, that could prove helpful long term, or it could prove helpful for another raid coming up. What?
Yes, both. And it could be tracking down other terrorists and what other terrorists are doing and finding out other terrorist names and contact information and what their activities are. Mm. So when the SEALs go in there or any special ops force goes in there and they collect all this intelligence, the value of the intelligence isn't known immediately. Sometimes it takes years. As you know, with bin Laden, that took 10 years to finally track down bin Laden. But the information they went after at a communications headquarters could be very, very valuable.
The New York Times has reported that just about everything that could go wrong with this mission did go wrong. From what you're hearing from former SEALs, what happened there?
They don't go into a mission or an operation haphazardly. Even after the president approves it and the commanders have approved it, when the guys are going in, they could back out anytime they wish. We can't second guess those guys on the ground. They have more experience than anybody in the history of the United States as far as pulling off these type of raids. Mm. So a botched raid is a terrible misrepresentation of that raid. It's very, very unfortunate we lost a SEAL. What the reality is that's the nature of war. We're going to lose more SEALs and we're going to lose more Americans as long as we have an enemy.
What, if anything, do you know about this mission, whether it had been compromised? And did the SEAL commanders think that it was at all during this raid? Are you hearing anything about that?
I am hearing that there's a chance it was compromised and there is a chance the people in the building knew there were enemy forces coming their way. And believe me, that's not the first time that has happened. You know, it's happened to me before where you're coming into something and someone gives warning that there is a helicopter. They landed 8 kilometers away. So by the time they were on the boots on the ground coming into the target, they were 8 kilometers away. So you really don't know what is happening as far as who could be giving them intelligence as far as a team coming in at that point. But yeah, it's very possible. Any one of these raids, it's possible it could be compromised again. And I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but again, that's the nature of war.
And that's a split-second decision by the SEAL commander on the ground whether to abort or continue to fight.
Well, he continually takes in all facts, all assets. He's looking, he's listening, he's got the ears on the ground, he's got radio, he's talking back to headquarters. And it's not a split-second decision. It's a well-thought-out decision for the commander to say it's a go or a no-go. My sorrow in this, besides losing our great man, Ryan Owens, besides losing him, is the way the U.S. has politicized this raid. These raids happen all the time. Hmm. This isn't the first raid where we've lost a SEAL, but because we've lost a SEAL and it's the first SEAL we've lost during this new administration, it's taking on different context. And that's the sad part. It's being used as a political leverage. And SEAL missions are the most challenging missions in the military. They will continue going on missions and fighting our enemy regardless who the president is or regardless of who said the missions are clear to go. It's just part of warfare.
It was a moving moment when the president turned to Karen Owens. But are you frustrated that a member of the SEAL community is now in the political fray in some ways?
Very much so. You know, the last time I went to a SEAL reunion, I was shocked by how many names were on the wall. You know, the first thing we do is we toast them all the guys who've given their lives, and we've lost so many SEALs over the last 15-plus years in these two wars we're involved in. It's very, very sad and a terrible thing. What SEALs have, we call it SOPs, the Standard Operating Procedures. When anybody gets hurt or killed, we go back to the drawing board and we think, what happened here? What went wrong? How can we prevent this from happening again? So these guys, they have the SOPs. When they go into a mission or an operation, they're guided by the standard operating procedures that what we say are written in blood. And they don't go haphazardly into a mission. If they thought it was going to be a failure, they would have turned back. Mm. It's very sad. It's very sad. You know, the reports are that women were killed and women were killed and shot and children were killed. To Americans, that is devastating. Any SEAL, any special forces, or any military member, that is a terrible, terrible thing. Unfortunately, what we have now is our enemy are hiding in communities filled with women and children, and now the women are picking up weapons, taking firing spots on the ground where they have cover and concealment and fighting when the guys come in the door. It's a whole different world. And the last thing we want in our military is to hurt a civilian. It makes the job a much more difficult task when you're going into a mission, trying your very, very best not to have civilian casualties. The enemy doesn't think that way, so they will use their women and children. And when they're firing at you and they're taking firing positions and shooting at the guys coming in the door, the person's looked at as a threat. You have to take out the threat.
But we should say we don't know in this case if civilians did take up arms and fire back at the SEALs. We just don't know yet.
I have seen some reports where women have picked up arms and taken firing positions and shot back.
In this raid?
In this raid, yes.
Okay. Bill Owens, Ryan's father, says he wants more answers. Is this just a grieving father, or are there questions for you that do need deeper answers?
We have to have deeper answers. I don't know if the public has to know it all, but the Pentagon has to have exact answers. Now, poor Mr. Owens, you know, a grieving father or a grieving mother or a grieving family member, I've spoken to so many of them over the years. Some take it differently. Some are very, very angry and frustrated. They just lost a son or a daughter, and it's the worst thing that's ever happened to them and the worst thing that'll ever happen to them. And others come and they have a bit of pride in their eye, and they said, although I lost my son or my daughter, I know they did it in defense of our country, and I'm very, very proud, and I know I will be proud of my son for the rest of my days, and I'm very sorry, and I'm going to miss him forever. But they look at it differently. But you can't blame any father or mother for wanting more answers. And right now, the media is pretty much making this a really big deal because it's politicized, a bigger deal than it should be. It should be a big deal because of the death of a SEAL, but it shouldn't be so politicized because of the election and all.
Mm. The media didn't invite the widow to attend a joint session of Congress, though. Mm. That was the president of the United States who did that.
I understand.
Yeah. Retired Navy SEAL Don Mann. His books include Inside SEAL Team 6, My Life and Missions with America's Elite Warriors. Don, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
By the way, the Pentagon says U.S. warplanes targeted al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen with more than 20 airstrikes today. The Pentagon statement does not connect these airstrikes with the January ground raid we just talked about.
ABC is premiering an ambitious 8-hour miniseries this week, documenting the struggle for gay rights from the 1970s to now. It's called When We Rise, and the first episode aired Monday night. Here's Austin P. McKenzie playing a young Cleve Jones, who would go on to become an activist. Jones is talking to his father, a Quaker doctor, played by David Hyde Pierce.
I have to give a speech in my psych class. The teacher is Mr. Banks.
I know him well.
And we have to pick a subject, and I've come to the conclusion that I would like to speak on something that I know about. So I'm going to be talking about the gay liberation movement.
Well, that sounds like an interesting subject, to be sure.
I'm gay, Dad. I'm gay.
Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And when we hear Cleve Jones being portrayed there, of course, he just came out with a book recently called When We Rise. We talked to him about it right here. But tell us about this series, When We Rise, and how it came to be.
Sure. So Cleve is a character, and we see him as a young man, and we also see him as an older man. He's one of several gay and lesbian characters whose lives are shown. And as we see their lives, we see the evolution of the gay rights movement in America, starting from around the time of the Vietnam War, when Cleve came out to his father, as we heard. And there's another character, a black character, who's a serviceman in the war and has to deal with both racism and homophobia. And there's another character who's a lesbian who wants to be active in the women's movement. But at that time, you know, the National Organization for Women didn't allow lesbians to be part of the group. And we see all of these different lives kind of come together and intersect when they all land in San Francisco at the same time as sort of the gay rights movement starts to take off. And there's all of these characters, except for the older Cleve, who's played by Guy Pearce, they're all played by relatively unknown younger actors. And then there's cameos from people like Rosie O'Donnell and Whoopi Goldberg. And so Dustin Lance Black, if you remember the movie Milk, he wrote that. He wrote this as well. And Gus Van Sant, who directed Milk, directed episodes of this as well. So it has quite the pedigree in terms of high-quality filmmakers getting involved.
Now, Eric, some reviews have said that there are parts of this series that veer too close to being a history lesson and not entertainment. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say that's probably the biggest criticism that I could give of it, is that there are lots of times when this feels like, you know, some sort of dramatization, and you can tell that it's meant to teach you something, you know, in all caps. And
which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Not necessarily a bad thing, but that is when the story kind of loses its power. And I think, you know, the point of this miniseries is particularly to reach out to maybe younger people to really give them a sense of the roots of the modern gay rights movement. And one of the things that this story talks about really well is this idea that different groups were kind of splintered from each other and almost opposed to each other in a way. I mean, we had people of color who were gay, who were ostracized both by their own ethnic communities and also, of course, faced a lot of homophobia. And then you had gay men who may have, you know, wanted to fight for gay rights, but weren't all that great on women's rights and weren't all that great on the civil rights struggle of people of color. And so this story is also sort of a parable for how all those groups really needed to come together in order to really effectively make change. There's a sense that even though it's a story that takes place in history, there's some lessons for today in it as well.
And what does it say to you that this show is premiering right after we just saw that the Oscar for Best Picture went to Moonlight, which also chronicles the story of a young black gay man?
Yeah, well, I think one of the complaints that I think people have had about a lot of stories about gay people in Hollywood culture, in TV and film, is that it's been focused on white males. It's been focused on cisgendered white males. And so to have a movie like Moonlight come along where it's the story of a young black man who is gay, that is a story we haven't seen much of. And I think what When We Rise also tried to do was tell the story of many different kinds of people who are involved in the LGBTQ community so that we weren't focused just on the travails of the white cisgendered male, which is typically where we've seen these stories told. And it's had other people sort of feel left out from some of the more classic tales about gay culture and coming of age of gay people.
Eric, because we mentioned Moonlight, I just have to ask you, do you think it's possible that that whole Oscar snafu was a ratings ploy to get people to tune into the Oscars next year?
Oh, no.
No?
Oh, no. Okay. No, I think that was so embarrassing for everyone who was involved that there is no way that happened on purpose. And there's, you know, I, along with many other people, subscribe to the theory that the guy who was supposed to hand Warren Beatty the right envelope was maybe a little too distracted tweeting from backstage and gave him the wrong envelope.
Right. Well, it was an interesting story to talk about. I will put it that way. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks so much as always.
Always a pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.